This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 6, Sautéing, Searing, and Pan Roasting. This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. So in today's episode, we're going to start our three-part series on hot side cooking techniques. And so by the end of this series and the whole series of podcasts, starting out from number one, you're going to have the tools to make a basic dish correctly. You know, you're going to understand how to cook your proteins properly, how to blanch and cook your vegetables properly, which we already went over, okay? And then moving forward, the last missing component to your dish is going to be sauces, right? And a basis to a lot of great sauces is the stocks, which we already went over in episode 2 and 3. But then we're going to do a 5-part series on the mother sauces after this 3-part series on hot side cooking technique. So that's just going to give you an idea of where this podcast is going in the next 8 episodes or so. And at the end of that, that's when we start getting into more sort of specialized areas and specialized content. Now, a little quick just house cleaning thing. At this, I'm pretty much following the outline that I originally created for the Free Culinary School podcast. Now I'm just updating it and going back a little bit better audio quality, adding some new techniques and some new tricks, a little bit more in-depth information. Now that I basically had 3 years to really think about the techniques and experience them from different points of view. But this is also the point in the original Free Culinary School series where I started getting questions regarding all the different podcast episodes that we discussed. So what I'm doing is I'm going to start the question and comment segment. And because these people took the time, even though it was, you know, a few years ago, to write me a question about a certain aspect of the podcast, in the following Q&A series, I'm basically going to read and answer their questions just as I did in the original podcast series. Then when we get all the way up to, you know, into the number 20 or 21 episode range, when we're talking about breads, and we're going to go into sauces and butchering and all that stuff, those are going to be the brand new Stella Culinary School podcast that the content was not released on the Free Culinary School podcast. But I just want you to understand that for your own knowledge. And if you're listening to this now, it means that we are live and the StellaCulinary.com website is live and we are rocking away. So if you do have a question, whether it's regarding episode 1, episode 10, or episode 50, if we're that far yet, feel free to email me, jacob@stellaculinary.com, and you know, give me your first name and, you know, a city or a state, you know, so you can be like Joe from San Francisco or, you know, Kevin from Alabama, whatever it is, and I'll read your question on the air. And we'll get it answered for you. And also, too, you know, I used to be able to answer my emails more readily, and I still strive to do that. And when you send me an email, try at the very very least to give you a 24-hour turnaround time. But what happens is now I'm so busy with scheduling certain events and corresponding with, you know, whoever's going to have an event at Stella Culinary or at the Cedar House and shooting it back and forth, is if you happen to send an email to me on a busy day, which can be any day of the week, depending upon what time of year it is, sometimes that email tends to get buried. So if you really want me to personally reply to an email of yours, and it's been, you know, say 48 or 72 hours, feel free to resend it and send me a little reminder. Say, hey, you know, I sent this a few days ago. Maybe it got buried. Can you please give me a response when you have a second? But also, the most efficient way is to go to stellacolony.com/forum, where I try my best to answer all the questions I can. But usually, one of our great forum members beats me to the punch. So that's just that for the questions. But today, before we talk about this sautéing, searing, and pan-roasting technique, I want to talk about a really interesting article that was written in the New York Times by Stephen Budiansky. I'm sure I'm butchering his name, but it's a great article called Math Lessons for Locavores. So back in August of 2010, Stephen Budiansky, who is a op-ed contributor to the New York Times, wrote an extremely compelling article called Math Lessons for Locavores. And you can follow him. Actually, he has his own blog called Liberal Curmudgeon, which, interesting name, I enjoy that. But here's the thing is, you know, at the Cedar House Sport Hotel, where we bill ourselves as being green and sustainable to whatever extent we possibly can be, right? And really to us, what that means is being conscious of the environment, being conscious of our waste, and conscious of basically this footprint that we leave on the planet, right? And it's something that, you know, it's one of those ideals that you need to strive for, that maybe not all the time you're knocking out of the park or completing, but as long as you keep it in the back of your mind, as long as you're conscious of some of the actions that you take, and how that could affect the environment or especially your surrounding local community, then I think you're going to be better off for it. And I think as a whole, we'll all be better off for it. Now, there's a movement called the locavore movement, which talks about eating locally and sustainably and, you know, trying to eliminate travel miles or what a lot of people you'll hear in the food industry call food miles. And you see a lot of chefs who, you know, especially some celebrity chefs who really get out in front of this. And what the problem is this whole sustainability thing is become less of a, you know, of a, I want to do good for the environment, I want to do good for my local community, and more of just this popular dogma that's a mantra that people just, you know, keep on repeating and repeating without giving it much thought. So, you know, Stephen Budiansky, he wrote this really thoughtful article called Math Lessons for Locavores. And he starts it, you know, second paragraph down, saying the local food movement now threatens to devolve into another one of those self-indulgent and self-defeating do-gooder dogmas. Arbitrary rules without any real scientific basis are repeated as gospel by locavores, celebrity chefs, and mainstream environmental organizations. Words like sustainability and food miles all are thrown around without any clear understanding of the larger picture of energy and land use. Now, it's important for us as chefs, right, to not get caught up in fervor and rhetoric. There's always going to be a new trend, and there's always going to be this new sort of movement, especially within our culinary field, because everybody can always, they can always connect with food, right? It's a very easy thing for people in general to connect with because it's a part of our daily lives. No matter what you do for a living, no matter who you are, you need to eat to survive. So it's very easy to get people whipped up in a frenzy over food, no matter how uneducated they are on the subject. And as chefs, it's our personal obligation to not get caught up in that and to be leaders out front in our local communities. And we need to make sure that we're leading by example and making informed decisions, not just repeating rhetoric that we may or may not know the basis of. Now, Stephen continues with the results, and I'm quoting now, have been all kinds of absurdities. For instance, it is sinful in New York City to buy a tomato grown in California because of the energy spent to truck it across the country. Yet it's virtuous to buy one grown in a lavishly heated greenhouse in, say, the Hudson Valley. the article continues to say the statistics brandished by local food advocates to support such doctrine assertions are always selective, usually misleading, and sometimes bogus. This is particularly the case with respect to the energy cost of transporting food. One popular and oft-repeated statistic is that it takes 36, sometimes up to 97, calories of fossil fuel energy to bring 1 calorie of iceberg lettuce from California to the East Coast. Now that's apples and oranges, or maybe apples and rocks, comparison to begin with, because you can't eat petroleum or burn iceberg lettuce. End quote. Now this is something that you'll hear a lot about, especially in the locavore movement, where they're talking about, you know, I only source food from 50 miles away or 100 miles away or 150 miles away. And there's always this sort of delineation of, well, you know, 150 miles is too far or 200 miles is too far. And, you know, you have to be at least 90% sustainable. But, like, who makes these rules? And why are these rules around? You know, and what good does it really do for us? Right? So he continues in his article to say, it is also an almost complete misrepresentation of reality, as those numbers reflect the entire energy cost of producing lettuce from seed to dinner table, not just transportation. Studies have shown that whether it's grown in California or Maine, or whether it's organic or conventional, about 5,000 calories of energy go into 1 pound of lettuce. Given how efficient trains and tractor trailers are, shipping a head of lettuce across the country actually adds next to nothing to the total energy bill. It takes about 1 tablespoon of diesel fuel to move 1 pound of freight 3,000 miles by rail. That works out to about 100 calories of energy. If it goes by truck, it's about 300 calories, still negligible. In the overall picture, for those checking the calculations at home, these are large calories or kilocalories, the units used for food value. Overall transportation accounts for about 14% of the total energy consumed by the American food system. Now here's the real point. When he's talking about the energy being consumed during the transportation, it's so small, right? A lot of the energy comes from the actual growing and manufacturing and the energy that it takes to actually produce the vegetable. But really, the big punchline is in the next paragraph, and I'm quoting now. The real energy hog, it turns out, is not industrial agriculture at all, but you and me. Home preparation and storage account for 32% of all energy use in our food system, the largest component by far. A single 10-mile round trip by car to the grocery store or the farmer's market will easily eat up about 14,000 calories of fossil fuel energy. Just running your refrigerator for 1 week consumes 9,000 calories of energy, and that's assuming it's one of the latest high-efficiency models. Agriculture, on the other hand, accounts for just 2% of our nation's energy usage. That energy is mainly devoted to running farm machinery, manufacturing fertilizer. In return for that quiet, modest energy investment, we have fed hundreds of millions of people, liberated tens of millions from backbreaking manual labor, and spared hundreds of millions of acres for nature preserves, forests, and parks that otherwise would have come under the plow. Now, these are just bits and pieces of his article that I suggest everyone go out and read. And I'm going to put a link in the episode 5 show notes to his article, Math Lessons for Locavores. And again, I would follow his blog as well, liberalcurmudgeon.com. And this isn't to say that I in any way endorse his political beliefs. And this really isn't a political show, right? But this article that he has written really brings light to an issue. And as an informed consumer, you need to understand all the different things at play here. Now, this isn't to say you shouldn't buy locally, but if you buy locally, do it to support your local economy and buy things that make sense, right? If you live in California, buy California tomatoes and California avocados and, you know, buy that stuff locally. But if it doesn't grow locally around you, don't force it to. You know, I don't agree with, you know, spending these hundreds of millions of dollars on greenhouses that create these fake environments that make, you know, just to expend that energy usage to force produce to grow outside of its natural environment. To me, that doesn't make sense. Also, it's incumbent upon us as chefs to support people and families and farmers who are doing a great job in producing the best quality product. Now, if that means I have to get my lamb from Colorado, so be it. If that means I get my Loch Dort salmon from Scotland because it's the only true sustainable salmon out there that doesn't lead to mercury poisoning or overfishing of the oceans, that's where I'm going to get my salmon from. So these are the informed decisions as a chef and as a cook and as a consumer that you need to make, especially regarding your food, since you consume food on a day-to-day basis. And making informed decisions about your food consumption is one of the largest roles you can play in making this world a better place. So in today's technique segment, we are going to discuss the first series in our hot side cooking techniques, and that is sautéing, searing, and pan roasting. Now, obviously, these are all stovetop methods that use a pan, one sort or the other, usually a sauté pan or a cast iron pan, and we're going to get more into that in a second. But let's also talk real quick before we even start about dry heat versus moist heat. Now, that's usually how the cooking applications are broken down, right? You have two sort of schools of cooking. You have dry heat and moist heat. Dry heat uses fat in a hot pan to cook something and to transfer heat into your food, whereas moist heat is going to be a water base, whether you're simmering something in stock, you're braising something, boiling, steaming. Those are all considered to be moist cooking techniques. Now, the general rule of thumb why you would use a moist cooking technique over a dry cooking technique is moist cooking techniques are usually reserved for tougher pieces of meat that contain a lot of collagen, right? And the moist cooking slowly breaks down this collagen over the long, slow cooking process. And it's going to give your meat the appearance of being tender, right? And it's really more just giving moisture back through the braising liquid. And we're going to get more into that during the braising and the poaching episode. Dry heat, on the other hand, is used for fast cooking of tender products, right? Whether you're searing a nice, beautiful filet mignon to rare or mid-rare, or sautéing those blanched baby carrots to bring them back to order, or pan roasting a nice hunk of salmon or halibut. These are all considered tender proteins or tender pieces of produce that you want to cook nice and quick to maintain flavor and integrity of the product. So the first thing we're going to talk about is sautéing. And sautéing literally means, translated from French, it means to jump. The motion is the definition. Now, one website, I'm not going to name names, but I was kind of surprised to see this, said that it means that when you're sautéing, so this is kind of ludicrous. It said that sautéing meant that what you're sautéing, whatever product you're sautéing, will jump out of the pan when it's done, which is, wow, that's insane. So, no, that's wrong. So don't listen to them, whoever they are. I'm not going to name names, like I said. But really, sautéing means to jump. It's the motion, right? So when you see a chef flipping a pan, it's that sautéing motion or that jumping motion is called or referred to as sauté, right? Now, it doesn't always mean that something has to be flipped or jumped out of a pan. So when they say sautéed scallopini, right, which is a larger item, it's a pounded piece of meat, it means that it is finished in a pan on the stovetop. So that can also be the terminology for sauté. Now, a sauté is always done in a sauté pan, which may seem kind of redundant, but there is a difference in your stovetop pans. A sauté pan is going to have those sloped, flared sides or edges, right? Versus a saucepan is going to have edges that are straight up and down. Now, the sloped edges or the sloped rim on your sauté pan is going to allow you to make that flipping motion and that flipping movement, okay? It aids in the sautéing motion. Now, the way that you do the sautéing motion, and I'm going to do a complete video series on these basic cooking techniques, so you're going to see a more in-depth video on the sautéing motion itself. All right, so don't really worry too much about that. But really, the whole key to a sautéing motion is limiting your upper body movement, right? And then using your forearm and your wrist, you know, kind of pushing out from your elbow, which the main part of your arm from your shoulder to your elbow is going to stay pretty close and tight to your side. And you're going to basically push your forearm forward while rotating your wrist in a smooth and relaxed motion. And when done properly in a hot enough pan, this is going to give you that nice saute flip that, you know, that you see chefs doing in the kitchen. Now, this motion does take time to learn, so don't get frustrated with it. And the two keys to making the proper saute motion are the proper heating of your pan and being relaxed during that motion, during that flipping motion. People tend to tense up, and then they don't really saute very well. They can't really make that motion. Now, the heating of the pan is really important. You always want to make sure that you heat your pan when you're sauteing over high heat, and you want to allow your pan to really heat up first before you add in your fat or your oil or whatever you're going to lubricate your pan with. Now, the reason why is because all pans have pores that open and close during the heating process. And when a pan is cold and lukewarm, those pores are still opening and closing, right? When you get your pan up to temperature, those pores are going to close more and allow your oil to float on the surface of the pan. So a good check is if you're not really sure, you can take a little quarter teaspoon of water and drop it in a hot pan. And it should kind of form into one singular ball and bounce around your pan. All right. And that's just a little tip. If it, you know, doesn't really dissipate that fast, then your pan's too hot. And if it just like completely just sizzles off and is, you know, acting crazy, then your pan's a little on the hot side, which isn't really that big of a deal. But your perfect temperature is when you drop in that ball of water and it bounces around your pan. Now, obviously, you know, I don't do that every time I saute something. But for people who aren't used to doing the hand check, where you hold your hand over your pan, and you know from experience, you know, if you hold your hand a couple inches away and it feels a certain way, certain kind of heat is given off, then your pan's hot enough. And you'll learn that over time just after, you know, sauteing, you know, hundreds of items. But once your pan comes up to heat and those pores are nice and closed, that's when you're going to add your fat. And you always want to add, you want to take into consideration that whatever you're going to saute, you know, some things soak up more fat than others, right? So if I'm going to, you know, dust a veal scallopini in flour, that flour is obviously going to suck up more fat than, say, some blanched baby carrots. Now, speaking of blanched baby carrots or any blanched vegetables that you're going to saute, you want to make sure that you thoroughly dry them and pat them dry with a towel or some paper towels. Let them just, you know, sit on a rack overnight in your refrigerator before you saute them. Because number one, it's what's going to happen if there's too much excess moisture and your pan's not hot enough, it's going to give off a bunch of steam and you're not going to get that nice caramelization, that quick cooking that you would during a nice saute. But also, too, when you have hot oil and cold water and they hit the pan, it usually tends to flare up and it'll spitter and spatter and sputter and you'll have a pan that's on fire, not too cool. So that's another thing that you want to take into consideration as well. And once your pan is nice and hot and you have your oil in there, you're going to let your oil come up to temp and get, you know, a little bit hotter. And you're going to throw in your product and you always want to make sure that you never overfill your saute pan. Okay, you want to, usually the rule of thumb is you want a singular layer of product, whether you're sauteing shrimp or vegetables, whatever you're sauteing. You want that a nice, flat, singular layer. And even then, sometimes you can overfill it. And you want to make sure that you're always constantly cooking over high heat. You want your stovetop, either your flame or your electric burner, to be to the highest setting. Okay, that's because the heat of your pan is really one of the defining factors of sauteing properly. You don't want to lose that heat. Now, when you're doing that sauteing, that flipping motion, you want to make sure that you're not taking the pan off of the stovetop for too long. Now, a lot of people will tell you, well, you got to, you know, shake it back and forth on your pan and flip it. But, you know, look, if you're using a nice heavy bottom saute pan, and your pan is hot enough to begin with, then taking your pan off of the flame for just the second or half a second it takes to give your sauteed items a couple of flips, it's not a big deal. You're not really going to lose that much heat. So don't really worry too much about that. Now, again, if you want to see some recipes and sort of more of a visual explanation of how to make that sauteing motion, check out the Stella Culinary School website, stellaculinary.com. and check out the episode 6 show notes, and I'll have a link to a video there. Now, the next dry heat technique we're going to talk about is searing, right? And people understand in general the concept of searing, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time kind of beating to death the terminology. But let's look at the purpose of searing. And searing is basically the one of the hottest cooking methods that you have out there besides, you know, roasting in a really hot oven, like a wood fire oven or something crazy like that. But really, you want to get your pan ripping hot. And it's really important to have a heavy bottom saute pan, or, you know, I think that everyone should own a cast iron pan, especially for searing applications. Cast iron pans really are not that expensive. They're actually a lot cheaper than a really, you know, heavy bottom, copper plated bottom saute pan. So definitely, if you don't have one, go spend the $10-$20 on a cast iron pan. Because the reason why it's important to have a really thick pan is heat retention during the searing process. Anytime you put a cold product like a steak or a piece of chicken or a piece of fish into a hot pan, what's going to happen is there's going to be a certain amount of heat transfer into the meat. And if what can very well happen if you have a thin pan that doesn't have like a heavy bottom on it, when that heat transfers into the meat, the pan recovery time takes a really long time. And that's what leads to uneven browning, okay? Because the longer it takes for that pan to recover, the longer it takes for your piece of meat to brown. Now, another thing to think about too, right, is you lay your protein, say you're searing a steak, in the center of a smoking hot pan, correct? Now, what happens is all the exposed surface area around that protein inside the pan is going to recover its heat a lot quicker than in the center of that protein. So that's what leads to having sort of the crispy, you know, dark black outer edges or dark brown outer edges and a non-brown center in the meat, on the surface of the meat. So that's why also, too, if you're not using a cast iron pan, you want to use a pan that's appropriate to the size of the protein or whatever you're searing. You want to use an appropriate size pan, okay? Because if I take a 12-inch heavy bottom saute pan and I try and sear a 4-inch piece of salmon filet, it's going to cook really uneven, all right? The centerpiece of that filet of the salmon surface is not going to brown, and the edges are going to blacken. So a cast iron pan, though, retains so much heat that you really don't get that uneven heat distribution, even if you're searing a small piece of meat in a large cast iron pan. So that's why I really recommend if you're going to sear something, you want to get a large cast iron pan and use it religiously. And in the culinary quick tip, I'm going to talk about how to properly season your cast iron pan. Now, the main purpose of searing something is for the Maillard reaction. And that is something that happens at around 320 degrees. And it's basically when something turns brown, that's the Maillard reaction. It's caramelization. Okay, and that caramelization tastes really, really good to our palate. It tastes a lot better than if you were just to take a regular filet and pop it in the oven and cook it till mid-rare, right? Which it's not really going to have enough time to roast that piece of meat. So usually when you sear something, it's followed by a secondary cooking process, whether you sear short ribs to create that caramelization and then drop it into your braising liquid, right? And then you cook them with a braise. Or you can sear your filet, transfer it to, you know, a roasting pan, and then finish it in your oven. Now, a very, very common misconception that I don't know why I still hear it, okay? I don't know why people still say it. It's crazy. And I hear, like, chefs who are really good at what they do, you know, saying that you got to sear your meat to lock in the juices. No, 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 no. That is not true. Okay, just because you sear something does not make it non-porous. Juices can still escape during the cooking process. That's why you have to, when you do your secondary cooking, roasting, or whatever, you have to be temperature conscious. Because no matter what, a certain amount of moisture will always escape from your meat. The reason why you sear something is for that Maillard reaction to make that nice, beautiful crust and for that caramely flavor that it gives you, because seared meat tastes better than unseared meat. That's just a general rule of thumb. Now, the best way to do this is you want, if, like I said, you want to use a cast iron pan. But when you put in your fat in your cast iron pan, the way that I like to do it is, you know, again, you want, and it takes a while to heat up a cast iron because, again, it consumes so much energy as far as it retains a lot of that energy heat. So it takes a lot of extra time in the form of energy and heat to actually get that pan up to temperature. But once it gets to temperature, it's going to hold its temperature. So then if you have a well-seasoned cast iron pan, you want to add in just a little bit of oil. And I like to use oil with a high smoke point and with a neutral flavor. And a couple good examples of this is grapeseed oil or canola oil. And their smoke points are over 400 degrees. Now, what happens if you see your oil start to smoke? It means it's breaking down and it's going to give off acrid flavors, and you don't want that. But another thing too, so something like an extra virgin olive oil, what gives it it's a flavor, what gives extra virgin olive oil its flavor is the fact that it has impurities in it, right? It's the first press of the olives. It hasn't been refined down. And the little impurities from the olives in the pits in the oil is what give a good extra virgin olive oil its unique flavor. But because of that, it's going to have a much lower smoke point, and it's not going to be the proper oil for searing. And olive oil, when it breaks down, can really give off a bad flavor when it's overheated. So really, you know, you want to use canola oil or grapeseed oil for high heat cooking processes, whether you're sautéing or searing. And then you want to save your olive oil, your really nice extra virgin olive oil, for finishing, because that stuff's not cheap anyways, you know. So, you know, get that full flavor boost, and you want to, you know, put that in right at the end. So that's just a little side note. But once the cast iron comes up to heat or whatever pan you're using, you want to add a little bit of oil, and then you want to wipe out any of that excess oil. All right, and that's very important because you want to have a clean contact. And then from there, just let it rip. You know, drop in your filet, drop in your salmon, whatever you're going to sear and crust. And then the real secret is you want to leave it alone. Resist the urge to flip and mess with it. You want to wait till you see that outer edge of your protein start to get a nice golden brown, and then let it go just a few seconds longer. And then give it a flip and check it out. And you know what? Chances are, if you've never seared a piece of meat before, you're not going to get it right on the first time. I didn't get it right the first 50 times. It takes a while to get used to, you know, checking for that sear and not messing with the crust. You know, looking for the indicator of the outer edge getting nice and golden brown. So don't get frustrated, but you will, after you sear, you know, enough times, you're going to start to develop what we call your kitchen sense. All right, you're going to start to sense when it's right to turn in. You're going to sense when that sear is done. And from there, you're going to continue with your secondary cooking option, which we're going to cover later, whether it's going to be braising, poaching, roasting, whatever that is. Now, the final thing is pan roasting, which is very common. It's almost like you're doing a sear, but it's a little bit different. And the way that I like to pan roast stuff is I actually like to do it on one side, right? And this is a great method for roasting your fish. So you're going to start much like you would with the searing process. But instead, you don't necessarily have to use a cast iron pan. In fact, I wouldn't use one only because it transfers a little bit too much heat when you go and you put it into the oven. And the size of your pan in proportion to your protein is really important with doing a pan roasting or a pan roti. So for example, if I'm doing, say, like an 8-ounce piece of salmon, I'm probably going to use a 6-inch saute pan to pan roast that single piece of salmon. Because again, when that recovery temperature of that saute pan comes back up around those outer edges, it's going to lead to uneven browning. But in the same respect, I don't want a pan that's too small, if I'm cooking like 3 or 4 pieces of salmon, to where it leads to overcrowding and the salmon fillets start to come up on the edge of the slope sides of the saute pan. So what you're going to do is you're going to lay in your... So let's talk about salmon or just a fish in general. I use this technique mainly for, say, fish fillets, whether it be bass or halibut or salmon. But I also use this too for duck and chicken. So start by getting an appropriate size pan heating on high. You want to add in your fat after the pan has gotten nice and hot. You don't want to go overboard, but you want to have enough fat to make sure that you have a nice conductive layer of because fat conducts heat better. But also, too, it's going to allow your protein to not stick so much. Once your pan comes up to temperature, you want to drop in your protein. And for fish, you always do it flesh side down skin side up, whether the skin's on or not. Because what happens is there's this subcutaneous layer of fat right underneath the fish skin. And during the roasting process, you never flip your fish. You only sear on one side and you leave it alone. And during that roasting process, the fat's going to melt down into your fish and sort of almost baste it and make it more tender and more flavorful. So let's use the example of doing a halibut. You're going to lay your piece of halibut in your nice hot pan, flesh side down, fat side up. And you're going to look for that outer edge of caramelization. And you're not going to take it quite as far as if you were searing because you're going to continue to cook it. Now, the whole trick of this technique is you never cheat and you never peek at that crust. You have to find that perfect timing where the outer edge of your protein starts to turn that nice golden brown, but not too dark. And from there, you're going to drop that that entire pan without ever flipping your fish or your chicken breast or your duck breast. You're going to drop the entire pan into a hot oven. And at the restaurant, I use a 500-degree oven. At home, you might be more comfortable with a 4 or 450-degree oven. But whatever it is, you want it usually around the highest, hottest setting of your oven. And you're going to roast it. Now, as during that roasting process, what's going to happen is that crust that you've never touched, you've never peeked at, and you've never flipped is going to continue to caramelize and form this really nice, even, beautiful crust. And at the same time, that piece of meat is going to roast in the oven and become nice and tender. Now, the reason why I don't flip my meat when I'm doing pan roasting is because I think it's counterproductive. You get too much of a crust. When you have a hard sear, a hard crust on both sides, say for a steak, you really get too much crust. And you want that nice, succulent sort of roasted flavor, especially when you're talking about fish or poultry, and just a little hint of crust to add that nice brown, meaty, caramelized flavor. Now, when you pull your fish or your chicken or your duck out of the oven. Now, this is all depending upon, you know, we can't really get into cooking temperatures right now, cooking times, because it's a whole other episode. But what we will do is when I'm going to demonstrate the roti technique using duck, using chicken, using a couple different fish fillets, and in those videos, in those separate videos, I'll talk about how I check for doneness and how I check for, you know, how long I usually will finish in the oven for. But real quick, for like a fish fillet, when you squeeze the sides of a raw piece of fish, it's going to kind of push in and not really respond. Now, if you squeeze a overcooked piece of fish, it's going to not have any give at all. A perfectly cooked piece of fish and a perfectly cooked piece of meat, in my opinion, or not in my opinion, in fact, unless you're actually trying to, you know, overcook the meat or cook it well done, is when you squeeze it, it's going to have a little bit of give and it's going to spring back at you, right? Now, another great technique for checking the internal temperature of fish is using a metal skewer. And you want it to be a nice, thin metal skewer, nothing that will really disrupt it. And what you do is you pull your fish out of the oven, you stick the metal skewer into the middle of the fish, you let it sit there for like 1 second, and you pull out that metal skewer and you touch it to your bottom lip. Now, if the metal skewer is hot, then like really hot, almost to where it's like it hurts to touch it to the bottom of your lip, then it means that your fish is overcooked. If it's nice and warm, your fish is perfect. If it's cold, your fish needs more time. So that's another trick that you can use as well. Now, one last thing is when your fish is done, when it hits that perfect temperature, you're going to pull it out of the oven. And a lot of times when cooking fish in general, when you're using the roti method, sometimes it takes a while for it to release from the pan. So if you go and you take your little fish spatula and you try and remove the fish from the pan and flip it over, and it starts to stick on you, don't force it, because you're going to leave that nice crust behind in the pan. You're going to defeat the whole purpose of the roti in the first place. So instead, just sit the pan off to the side, let it rest for about anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes. And I usually just, when this happens to me at the restaurant, I just take the pan and I have a little heat shelf right above my stove and I can set it there. At home, you can just set it on one of your back burners that isn't on. And that as the pan cools down, the fish is going to release from the pan, and you're going to be able to flip it over and remove it without leaving that crust behind. Now, if you're using a newer sauté pan, sometimes it takes a while to actually season that sauté pan up a little bit, and you're just out of luck, unfortunately. It's going to take a couple of pieces of fish kind of leaving their crust behind before that sauté pan actually is going to release that fish from its clutches. Now, what I'm going to do, because this is such a versatile technique, this is actually going to be the first video in the technique series. Now, as of right now, I'm concentrating on getting this website built and getting a lot of content up there, you know, getting those audio lectures done and all the articles switched over and, you know, edited down and all that good stuff. So the video making process, for the most part, is kind of taking a back seat. But I will take the time to make one video on pan roasting. Actually, I'll make two. I'll do a video on pan roasting, a video on sauteing that will be guaranteed that when this podcast is released, will be over in the episode 6 show notes. So check that out. And so for your homework, I want you to go out and get yourself a piece of fish or get yourself a you know, a chicken breast with a skin on and practice the roti method. Or I want you to do a vegetable saute. And again, there will be videos demonstrating how to do both of those. And you can take videos or pictures and upload them to the forum. And if you have problems, now would be a great time to post them to the forum and get those answers while it's still fresh in your mind. Also, you can go over and take the sauteing, searing, and pan roasting quiz, which you can use to reinforce the knowledge that you learned today. So in today's question and comment segment, which used to be the announcement segment, and we're just going to kind of combine the two, I got a couple of questions from past episodes that people are talking about and asking. So here we go. The first one comes from Mecca, and it's concerning risotto. And she says, can you use arborio rice to make rice pudding? If you can, should you use water or milk? Would using arborio rice be a good way of giving the pudding a creamy texture without using too much cream? Well, I've never tried this technique, but I would assume that you're on to something as far as, you know, using the starches in the arborio rice to cream out and give it a nice texture, right? The problem is you'd have to drastically overcook your arborio, which arborio tends to be more expensive than, you know, regular rice, so you might not want to use it for that application. But also, too, part of the yumminess of rice pudding comes from the addition of fat in the form of cream and butter. So if you're looking to make a low-fat and a low-cream rice pudding, I can't really advocate that. It's against my religion. I'm sorry. So I would recommend trying to make a rice pudding with arborio rice, but please don't leave out the fat and the cream. It's just going to, more butter, more better. Okay, so make it with risotto. Get back to us. Let us know how that worked for you. But really, I would just use regular rice, and I would save your arborio rice for your risotto applications. Now, the next question comes from Old Fat Sailor, and he says, could you clarify the distinction between spice and seasoning? Always been a bit of a confusion to me. And that's a great question because we did talk about how pepper was a flavoring agent or a spice, and salt was a seasoning in the last episode, my little salt and pepper rant, right? So seasoning is basically a flavor enhancer that brings out the natural flavors in a dish. They're usually a part of the four major flavor groups that our tongue can taste: sweet in the form of sugar, salt or salty in the form of salt, sour can be, you know, vinegar, and bitter, such as how hops improve the flavor of a beer, gives it more depth. Spices, on the other hand, are things like nutmeg, cinnamon, star anise, that not only help enhance the flavor of a dish, but can also play a starring role. Whereas salt, sugar, and vinegar are added as a seasoning to the point where they bring out the natural flavor, but are not really detected, and this more is for savory food. Spices are in-your-face flavors that add a different taste component to the dish and can really, you know, bring a certain, you know, one-two flavor punch combination. So that's the difference between spices and seasonings. Now, the next question comes from Anonymous, and she says, my grandmother always swore that chicken feet were essential to a good chicken stock. I can get them at the Chinese grocery store without much difficulty. Do you have thoughts on chicken feet in stock? My grandmother always said that feet are especially dirty, so she would cover them in water, bring to a boil, pour off the water, recover with cold water, and start again. Do you think this is necessary for sanitation purposes? Well, as far as the sanitation goes, that's completely up to you. You just look at your feet. If you're getting them from a busy store, shouldn't be a big deal. You could just as easily scrub them under cold water. And that's just more to not impart dirty flavors to your stock. Because really, quite honestly, whatever sort of thing is living on the chicken feet, as long as they're not completely rotten, which they obviously shouldn't be, the long cooking time and simmering time of your stock is going to kill whatever bacteria is on there. So you can blanch them. If that's what your grandmother showed you and that's what you're used to, you can blanch them in boiling water and pour it off and then use them. But just make sure that your feet are clean to begin with, and it shouldn't be an issue. Now, as far as using feet in your stock, I'm definitely an advocate of it. And the reason why they make a good addition to chicken stock, as well as the necks and the wings, is because they contain a lot of collagen. Remember, we talked about collagen and how it breaks down into gelatin, and that's what's going to naturally thicken your stock, especially during the reduction process. So if you want to use your chicken stock for a more hearty application, whether you're doing a pan sauce or a pan reduction, or maybe you just don't want it quite as watery, right? You want it to be a little bit more full body and full flavor, then the addition of chicken feet, necks, or wings are really going to add more gelatin or collagen, which breaks down to gelatin, is going to give you a much better flavor and, more importantly, a much better texture. All right, so in today's culinary quick tip, I'm going to give you the nice little process on how to properly season your cast iron pan. Remember, we were talking about the importance of having a well-seasoned cast iron pan, especially for searing. Now, back in the olden days, before Teflon really came about and they had the Teflon-coated pans, a well-seasoned cast iron pan was a prized possession of, passionate cooks everywhere, because it was the original nonstick pan, nonstick cooking surface that, when it was seasoned properly, you could actually sear and cook things without having any excess fat or oil in your pan. It was really just a nonstick surface. And there used to be lockers where cooks would actually just take their own personal seasoned cast iron pan. They'd lock them in their lockers at the end of their shift because they don't want anyone screwing up their nice surface. Now, you want to treat your cast iron pan gently and gingerly, and there is a whole process for after you're cooking it, how to clean it. And let's talk about real quick on how to properly season a cast iron pan. Now, whether it's brand new or years and years old and the seasoning is messed up, you're going to start it exactly the same. You want to preheat your oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit, 176 degrees Celsius. And while your oven is heating up, you want to take out your pan, you want to give it a good scrub with soapy water, you want to really scrub that pan good. Now, this is the only time that you should ever scrub your pan with water or soap. All right, it's going to really take off any sort of surface that you've built up, and so you really want to make sure that this is the only time you do this. Now, if you have an older cast iron pan that's really beat up, a lot of times that you'll find that on the inner surface, you'll have a lot of like chunks of black carbon that are built up over time. So the best way to take this is a little like a paint spatula or the little paint scraper. You got to go and you got to chip off all that carbon because you're not going to be able to remove it with just soapy water and a little metal scrubby. So once you've chipped off all that carbon and you've scrubbed it really good, you want to rinse it really, really well, and you want to dry it. Make sure there's no residual water left over. Next, you want to place a tablespoon of a vegetable shortening or vegetable oil right in the center of your pan. And you want this enough to when it melts down, it needs to be an even layered coating inside the pan. Next, place your pan with your shortening or your fat or your oil in your oven and let it melt down and let it basically cook in your oven for about 45 minutes to 60 minutes. Then you're going to pull your oven out and be careful because it retains a lot of heat and it could easily burn you. So use an oven mitt or a nice thick side towel. Pull it out and you're going to take a paper towel and you're going to wipe that melted fat all around the inside of that pan, all up the edges, all down on the cooking surface, and then to take the residual fat and rub it on the outside as well. Now, it's really important that you wipe in as much fat as possible and you have any excess fat left that recovers out onto your paper towel that you're using to wipe the pan. You're going to place that pan back in your oven, and this time you're going to invert it. Right, you're going to put your pan in upside down. And this is because any residual oil left in the pan can actually turn into a really hard coating surface that can actually chip off into your pan during the later cooking process. So any excess oil that is left in your pan during this process, if your pan is flipped upside down in the oven, it's going to drip out and it's going to give you a nice even coating. Now you want to bake that pan for about an hour And then you want to turn off the oven and allow the pan to cool back down in the oven. When that cooling period has finished, take out your cast iron pan, wipe off any excessive fat with a clean paper towel, and store. Okay, now you're going to notice immediately it's going to have this nice, smooth, seasoned finish. Now, when you're using your pan in the future after you season it, you never want to use soap and water. You want to let the pan cool slightly and add kosher salt and a little bit of oil. Now, if you have a really good finish, sometimes all that's necessary is you take a kitchen towel, and once you remove your meat when you're done during the cooking or searing process, you can simply wipe your pan out with your kitchen towel and it'll be nice and clean because you have that nonstick surface. Now, if it requires a little more cleaning, if there's little bits of meat or caramelized whatever in the bottom of your pan, go ahead and add in a little bit of a canola oil or whatever fat you're using to cook. But you want to use a high temperature oil like canola or grapeseed oil. And you want to add in a little bit of kosher salt and you scrub the pan with that oil and the salt mixture. Then you want to take that pan, again, never add water to it, wipe that salt and that oil out into a trash can and wipe your pan clean with a nice kitchen towel. Now for more information on this technique and a written version of this entire seasoning process, head on over to stellaculinary.com and check out the episode 6 show notes. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. Questions or comments, check out the Stella Culinary Forum at stellaculinary.com/forum. You can always tweet me at Chef Jacob. Make sure you sign up for our amazing seasonal newsletter. Trust me, it is a resource you do not want to miss. Also, if you want your question answered live on the air, email me, jacob@stellaculinary.com. And until next time, this is Jacob with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to cook with passion.